In 2001, Australia invaded Afghanistan along with the United States and the United Kingdom. 20 years later, these countries are still occupying Afghanistan after promising they would bring peace and stability. Stupendous amounts of money, resources, and manpower have gone towards this occupation, all in the name of nation building. And as it turns out, a lot of these resources have been used to commit horrific acts against the people of Afghanistan. In late 2020, an inquiry into war crimes committed by Australian Special Forces in Afghanistan was finally released. This 465-page report, titled the Brereton Report, was initiated in 2016 and took several years to complete. The report found that 39 Afghan civilians were alleged to have been unlawfully killed by or involving Australian Defence Force members. None of these alleged crimes took place in the heat of battle, and the victims were non-combatants or no longer combatants. The report is broken down into three parts. However, a lot of it is heavily redacted. Not just the names of individuals, but in some cases, entire events are redacted. One of the shocking practices revealed in this report is known as blooding. This practice is another extremely disturbing aspect of these war crimes. Essentially, what would happen is you'd have a platoon commander who would take a new squad member and have them execute a detained prisoner. The prisoner would be unarmed, in cuffs, and posing no threat whatsoever. The term used in this report is also of interest because they referred to this as an unlawful killing. What it really is an execution. It's cold-blooded murder. Calling it an unlawful killing is just a way to water down the horror of what we're discussing here. But you can't do that. What we're talking about here are war crimes. We're talking about murder. There is no way to sugarcoat atrocities like this. Another practice that we're also made aware of is throwdowns. Basically, what this means is that special forces would carry weapons that are not regularly issued by the Australian or British military and then plant them on a prisoner after executing them. They would throw it down on the ground next to them, a throwdown. This would make it look like the prisoner wasn't executed, but instead killed during a firefight or because they had supposedly pulled a knife, for example. None of which was true, of course. It's important to note that the Brereton Report is not in fact a criminal investigation, but an inquiry conducted by the Inspector General of the Australian Defence Force. This is a role that is separate from the chain of command in the Australian Armed Forces and is appointed by the Secretary of Defence. The Brereton Report makes a number of recommendations following the inquiry, some criminal, others promotions, others pardons. However, it's not clear which cases they're referring to, because a lot of it has been redacted. Again, another war crime, which didn't come from the Brereton Report, but is still one of the most striking nonetheless, is a video that was released by Four Corners. It shows three men from the Australian SAS chasing an Afghan farmer with a German Shepherd. They catch up to him and gather around him as he is lying on the ground. At one point, one of the SAS can be heard asking if he should drop the man. There's an inaudible answer, after which we see him execute the Afghan farmer at point-blank range using his machine gun. It's sickening, it's grotesque, and it's a war crime that makes someone feel physically ill just by watching it. The man who was executed in the video was 26 years old. His name was Dad Muhammad. They said later that he was carrying a radio, supposedly, and that this proved that he was an insurgent, and that's why they killed him. This turned out to be a lie. There was no radio recovered. And even if there was, one has to ask the question, how does carrying a radio merit an execution at point-blank range? After the release of the Brereton Report, a Chinese official posted a doctored image on Twitter of an Australian soldier with a knife in reference to the war crimes committed by their special forces. What's interesting here isn't so much the image, but the reaction it garnered, particularly from Australian officials. Australia's parliament was outraged by it, and Australia's prime minister issued a statement rebuking the Chinese government, demanding an apology. Apparently, the Australian government is more offended by people exposing and calling out its war crimes than the actual war crimes themselves perpetrated by its own soldiers. David McBride, a former lawyer and major in the Australian Defence Force, leaked evidence of war crimes to the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, ABC. After this happened, ABC's offices were raided by police. And I think it's extremely interesting and worth pointing out here that when supposedly liberal democracies like the United States, Australia, and the UK have embarrassing information about them leaked to the press, all notions of freedom of speech and press freedoms suddenly seem to go out the window. We saw this with the raid on ABC, with the persecution of Julian Assange, and numerous other whistleblowers across the years. After leaking evidence of war crimes committed by Australian Special Forces in Afghanistan to ABC, David McBride faces 5 charges, including those of theft of Commonwealth property, breaching the Defense Act, and disclosing information without due authorization. This could result in him going to jail for decades. He joins me now to talk more. Thanks for taking the time, David. It's good to have you on.
Thank you, Richard.
So, David, I want to start out with the prosecution that you're up against. You're facing several decades in jail now because you exposed war crimes committed by the SAS in Afghanistan. You detail how you tried going up the chain of command, and they put these roadblocks and obstacles in front of you. Can you maybe elaborate on some of the mechanisms that an institution like the Australian military, perhaps the British and the American military, might put in place to prevent whistleblowers like you from disclosing the truth and exposing wrongdoing?
It was at war crimes that I first noticed a problem. It was more that we didn't tell the truth about anything, about small things as well as big things. That the war looked like it was being run to win domestic elections rather than to actually make a difference in Afghanistan. And I started to get suspicious because when I made complaints, they weren't treated seriously. And in fact, the message that seemed to be coming back to me was, shut up, stop making waves, what's going on is way above your pay grade. And there were some things which looked like cold-blooded murders, but they weren't being investigated, or that were just being whitewashed. And I was like, well, how can that be? How can you not look into something which looks like children are being killed?
The Brereton report, which was concluded in late 2020, says the SAS killed 39 Afghan civilians. That's the official figure. How many of those special forces that committed these murders were prosecuted or held accountable? And do you think that figure of 39 casualties is legitimate? Do you think it's accurate?
There's only one person who ever put on a uniform for Australia who was facing a trial and significant jail time at this stage, and that is me. And I think even the government finds that an uncomfortable fact. The report, as you know, was only finished late in 2020, and it wasn't a conviction of anybody. It was simply a non-criminal report, like an inquiry, which recommended charges, didn't even recommend charges. It recommended the police look at those 39 matters and, if necessary, charge people. And the wheels of justice, even when they're sort of being totally run honestly, take a long time. And it's quite possible we won't even have a trial on this until 2030. In relation to the amount of murders, I don't know that it was that many more, but it's a significant number because it wasn't, a lot of people must have known. And that's why it's truly significant, because you'd say a lot of people must have known, a lot of people must have said nothing. And not only that, what is more worrying than, say, if it had been at 300, was that often we rewarded the perpetrators of the murders. We gave them medals. We made them sort of media superstars. And I think that's the really sickening thing to say. Who gets ahead in our society? You know, the person that does the right thing, or the person who is the most sneaky, the most ruthless, the person that actually thinks our laws are just a joke.
David, are you concerned about Australia's geopolitical standing, its place on the international stage? Because a lot of people seem to see it as doing the bidding of the United States, being in this confrontation with China. Assange is another aspect of that.
It completely is, that it does worry me a lot. We will never move forward as a country until we take a good hard look at what they euphemistically call the strategic relationship. The idea, and that means we just do whatever America wants. And the idea is that they will look after us, if we ever got invaded. But I mean, that's highly questionable. And I would rather stand on our own. They make us buy their equipment. They use us. Obviously, we don't have a very big army, but it has a very potent effect. And it means that when they go on these expeditions to Middle Eastern countries, it doesn't look like they're acting on their own. So having Australia is powerful for them.
So Donald Trump, he sanctioned the ICC for investigating war crimes in Afghanistan. Israel is now scared that the ICC might investigate them. Do you think that Australia has handled the SAS war crimes adequately? And if not, and I think I already know the answer, but if not, do you think that the ICC should be stepping in to prosecute military officials and politicians involved with that?
I believe the ICC, I believe that was the motivation for the Brereton report. That was the real motivation. I spoke to a senior lawyer back in 2014 and I said, what's going on? There's obviously some big cover-up. There's something strange going on. As I said, we're prosecuting people we shouldn't be prosecuting, and we're not prosecuting the famous guys that need it. And he said, we're worried about the ICC. And I didn't understand at the time. I thought, well, the ICC don't have any jurisdiction in Australia unless it's pretty serious. Well, I didn't realise that it was a lot more, it was serious enough for the ICC. They knew it back in 2014. And everything they've done since, because the ICC can't prosecute you if you have carried out prosecutions yourself. I think they think they're being really clever, because imagine it's not clear what carrying out prosecutions means. And so if you're carrying out prosecutions yourself for 50 years, then that probably qualifies, you know, or whatever. By the time they're all be retired, and the reason why the ICC scares them, the ICC has a tendency to go for the leadership. And this is how, you know, spineless our people are. They don't really care about the soldiers doing things wrong or whatever, but they worry that they might be in the frame and they might get before the Hague. And so they need to find some scapegoats fast, and they need to draw it out. And I think that was the really cynical motivation about Brereton, was to get, because unlike the US, we're a signature, this is typical Australia, going back to Maurice Payne. We can't sign up to these things quick enough. We sign up to anything and we're like, oh, we're such a good nation, you know, we signed up to the ICC. And I think a lot of the time too, people just want to go on junkets to nice sounding, Rome was where the ICC was put together. But they don't really think about what it means to be a member. And now the Americans have, of course, never signed up to it. And now we're backpedaling really fast. We will be complicit, even though we're a signatory to the ICC, a founding member. And the Americans, Pompeo's absolutely outrageous idea that he was going to put sanctions, that he made the ICC the bad guys. Yeah, to try to make out that like the ICC were the criminals, Australia of course did nothing. And again, this is that creepy thing about, you know, being the beholden to the US. We either need to get out of the ICC or we need to say something about that Pompeo's actions, and they're pretty outrageous. But I think that's the. Unfortunately, you hang around, you know, the bullies long enough and you become like them. And we are, I think the only reason, we even did the inquiries was to keep the ICC off our back. We didn't support the ICC when Pompeo was putting sanctions on them. I'm like, oh my God.
Because like you said, these investigations, they literally take years. And you also had the UK inquiry, Operation Northmoor, where they're investigating war crimes in Afghanistan. And of course, no one is found guilty.
I think that's another good example. I'm glad you brought it up. I think that that's what we're getting in Australia. And unfortunately, all these people who work in the government, they've seen the same playbook. You know, make a big noise about something for long enough, throw enough money, but then make sure nothing ever happens. It's the sort of thing they do with political investigations, you know. Whereas if you only care about public appearances, that sort of thing makes perfect sense. You know, if you're not actually trying to do the right thing, just trying to win elections, of course double dealing and mixed messages and playing one side off another, a bit like the American elections, you know, the partisan politics serves a purpose. And if public perception and opinion polling are your goals, your ultimate goals, why not just mess with the truth the whole time? You know, a trial is really just a way to look good temporarily. And if you have to have a trial but make sure the person gets acquitted, that's a win-win as far as these very cynical, you know, reputation management people would go. And pretty much everything that the U.S., not just the U.S., but all the Western nations is doing in the Middle East is a sham.
David McBride, thank you so much for your time. It's great speaking with you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your great work.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
The United Kingdom, which also invaded Afghanistan in 2001, is also embroiled in its own war crimes scandal. Britain's Special Forces, also named the Special Air Service, the SAS, were found to be committing war crimes going back many, many years. These war crimes involved many of the same things we just looked at, such as blooding or throwdowns, and were also systemically covered up by the entire chain of command. An inquiry was also launched, called Operation Northmoor, yet not a single soldier or politician was held accountable. These atrocities were reported on years before when the Sunday Times, in cooperation with the BBC, published internal emails showing that troops in Afghanistan were casually discussing these war crimes among themselves. For example, in late 2010 and early 2011, British Special Forces from D Squadron in the 22nd Special Air Service Regiment conducted several night raids in Helmand Province in Afghanistan. During these nighttime raids, they would regularly execute dozens of unarmed Afghani men, committing the most horrendous of war crimes with complete impunity. On February 16, 2011, the SAS stormed the house of a man named Saifullah Gharibyar. They executed his two brothers, his cousin, and his father. All his family members had been unarmed and were already in custody at this point when they were murdered. Afterwards, the SAS falsified their operational summary or OPSUM reports, claiming that these men had brandished weapons of some sort. They did this for practically every raid, these throwdowns. The report goes on to detail how British commanders became aware early on of a deliberate policy of executing Afghani civilians, particularly men. In one email published by the Sunday Times, a major in the SAS remarks that there were more bodies than weapons. This clearly indicates that either the weapons had gone missing, or the men were never armed to begin with, and these reports were fabricated or falsified. The numbers literally did not add up. In another email, soldiers casually talk about the latest massacre, indicating how common these occurrences were. The UK's Ministry of Defense claims that a, quote, breakdown of communication, unquote, between the Ministry of Defense and lawyers is the reason that no action ended up being taken. Operation Northmore was set up in 2014 to investigate these crimes, and yet here we are in 2021, and not a single person has been found guilty despite all of these killings. How is that possible? It's extraordinary that none of these investigations, whether we're talking about Operation Northmore or the Brereton Report, have resulted in any successful prosecutions or convictions or even criminal proceedings beginning. How is it that Australian, British, and American special forces get away with murder, literally? The end result of this is that these actions not only disgrace the uniforms of these countries, but also blow a giant hole in the mission these countries allegedly came to accomplish. If their original goal was supposedly to bring peace and stability, this is not it. Executing unarmed men and getting away with murder literally is not nation building or bringing peace and stability and security to Afghanistan. It's a horrendous, brutal occupation that cannot be justified and is ultimately self-defeating. In some cases, when Afghan civilians were executed by special forces, their families were paid compensation by British and Australian troops, who did so without acknowledging any wrongdoing. If you look at the sums mentioned, in some cases it's around $2,000 or $3,000. According to the Sunday Times, in July of 2012, an Afghan mother named Bebe Harasta watched as British SAS shot dead her three sons, Noor, Dean, and Zaire Muhammad, in the courtyard of her own home. They were just farmers. The British then paid her £3,000 and just left. Of course, the British government denies any wrongdoing. And in another instance, reported by ABC, Australian Special Forces killed a man named Bismillah Azadi and his 15-year-old son Sadiq Allah while they lay sleeping. According to Bismillah's cousin, he found them dead and the bed riddled with bullets. The Australian Special Forces had left some cash with the corpse and left. Is that how much the United States, Britain, Australia think Afghan lives are worth? A few thousand dollars? This is not just repulsive, it's extremely insulting and dehumanizing. Foreign invaders come to Afghanistan, kill Afghan civilians in front of their families, pay them a few pennies, and then just move on to the next village or next town as if they did nothing. And the world stays silent and allows this to continue for decades. Is this it? Anyone with a shred of decency would be shocked and offended by what's going on. And these are just the things that we know of. More recently, there's a bill going through the British Parliament called the Overseas Operations Bill, which is extreme cause for concern. This bill seeks to eliminate accountability for British troops who commit war crimes overseas by introducing a statute of limitation of 5 years after the event has happened, if it's even investigated. This means war crimes, torture, abuses of various kinds would go unpunished, essentially. Not just in terms of the soldiers committing the acts, but all the way up the chain of command. No one would be held responsible. It effectively eviscerates accountability for war crimes and does nothing to prevent them in the future. It's an assault on human rights in the clearest sense and an indication that the British government intends to continue the trend of letting war crimes go unpunished. If there's one thing we've learned from these investigations, it's not just that war crimes have been committed with absolute impunity and that these horrific practices like blooding and throwdowns are going on, but that there's also been a systemic cover-up going up the entire chain of command. It's really worth thinking about what is more concerning here, the fact that these war crimes have taken place at all, or that military officials and politicians are able to get away with them and escape unscathed after failing to prevent them from happening in the first place and letting them continue when they knew the horrors that were taking place. Honestly, both are equally terrifying and equally unacceptable, most of all to the victims and their families. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer convicted of murdering George Floyd, has asked the judge for a new trial, according to a court document filed on Tuesday, 4th of May. Derek Chauvin's attorney, Eric Nelson, said his client had been deprived of a fair trial, adding that there had been prosecutorial and jury misconduct and errors of law at trial and that the verdict was contrary to law. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at the British newspaper The Guardian. The piece is titled, Derek Chauvin, ex-officer convicted in George Floyd's murder, asks for new trial. Stay with us for more. Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer convicted of murdering George Floyd, has asked the judge for a new trial, according to a court document filed on Tuesday, 4th of May. Derek Chauvin's attorney, Eric Nelson, said his client had been deprived of a fair trial, adding that there had been prosecutorial and jury misconduct and errors of law at trial and that the verdict was contrary to law. Eric Nelson cited many reasons in his request for a new trial, including allegations of prosecutorial and jury misconduct. Nelson also said Judge Peter Cahill, who presided over the trial, had abused his discretion when he denied an earlier request for a new trial based on publicity during the proceedings, which Nelson said threatened the fairness of the trial. Derek Chauvin's attorney, Eric Nelson, also took issue with Judge Peter Cahill's refusal to sequester the jury for the trial or admonish them to avoid all media, and with his refusal to allow a man who was with George Floyd at the time of his arrest to testify at court. The move comes 2 weeks after Derek Chauvin was found guilty of second and third degree murder and manslaughter in George Floyd's killing. A 12-member jury swiftly and unanimously found Derek Chauvin, a 45-year-old, guilty on all three counts he faced, following 3 weeks of testimony from 45 witnesses, including bystanders, police officials, and medical experts. The rare verdict against a police officer is considered a milestone in the fraught racial history of the United States, and a rebuke of law enforcement's treatment of black Americans. Ben Crump, an attorney for the George Floyd family, called the verdict a turning point in American history for accountability of law enforcement at the time. In a confrontation captured on video, Derek Chauvin, a white veteran of the police force, pushed his knee into the neck of George Floyd, a 46-year-old black man, for more than 9 minutes on 25th of May 2020. Derek Chauvin and three fellow police officers were attempting to arrest George Floyd, accused of using a fake $20 bill to buy cigarettes at a grocery store. Eric Nelson also asked the judge, Peter Cahill, for a hearing to impeach the verdict on the grounds that the jury committed misconduct, felt race-based pressure, felt intimidated or threatened, and or failed to adhere to jury instructions, though the filing did not include details about that assertion. To impeach a verdict is to question its validity. The brief did not mention recent reports that one of the jurors participated in a 28th of August march in Washington, D.C. to honor Martin Luther King Jr. That juror, Brandon Mitchell, has defended his action, saying the event was to commemorate the 1963 March on Washington and was not a protest over George Floyd's death. George Floyd's brother and sister, Philonise and Bridget Floyd, and relatives of others who had been shot by police addressed the crowd at the march last summer. A request for a new trial is routine following a guilty verdict and often mirrors issues that will be raised on appeal, said Mike Brandt, a Minneapolis defense attorney who has been closely following the case. If this request is denied, it can add another layer of decisions for Eric Nelson to appeal. Mike Brandt and others have said Derek Chauvin's convictions are unlikely to be overturned. Brandt said Eric Nelson will likely file more detailed written arguments on these issues. The purpose of holding a hearing to impeach the verdict would be to develop a factual record and present evidence that could determine whether the verdict was compromised. If a hearing is granted, it's likely that Mitchell would be called in to answer questions, according to Mike Brandt.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing 69 Minutes of 86 Days, directed by award-winning Norwegian filmmaker Egil Hoshel Larsen. And joining me in the studio, we have Maria Duarte, who is a film critic for the Morningstar newspaper and who has also worked as a news journalist in both television and radio for many years. And beside her is Zita Holborn, who is the co-founder and national chair of Barack UK and has been coordinating solidarity, aid and fact-finding missions in support of refugees in France for over 2 years. Now, 69 Minutes of 86 Days is a documentary about the hardships of being a refugee as seen through a child's eyes. With minimal dialogue, the director takes us into the journey of 3-year-old Syrian child Leanne and shows her family trekking through Europe with the goal of reuniting with her grandfather to settle in Sweden. First of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, I have to say, I thought this was a magnificent documentary, extremely moving, and it's the kind of documentary that stays with you for days, especially because it was told from a child's perspective. Now, Maria, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your impression of this documentary?
Well, it does stay with you, and I found that it was one of the most unique documentaries on the refugee crisis that I've seen, and actually quite an impressive directorial debut by Larsen himself. He was a cameraman, he was a cinematographer, and you can tell that in the way that it's shot. And what's interesting is that he shot it from her perspective and her height. So the camera moves with her. And it's very intriguing and inspiring use of putting this story across. And it's quite a humanizing way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. And the little girl is well, adorable. And the fact is that there are no voiceovers, there's no narration, you have no idea what's going on, very much like the little girl herself, Leanne. She has no idea. You know, at 3, you go where you're taken. And for her, in many ways, it was kind of like a game, although at times the camera kind of stays on her and she looks really, really serious.
I wanted to ask you actually a bit more about that point, yeah. about the style of the filmmaking, because the Larson does use low angle steady cam shots with mixed with long takes, as you were saying. And do you think that the director Larson was successful in trying to transfer the child's experience to the viewer in this way?
Well, I think so, because you can see her energy and her hope and her childlike wonderment. When the film opens, it's a tracking shot of the beach, and you see all these things strewn on it. You have no idea what's coming or where it's going, and then it kind of tracks up. You see all these refugees queuing up. They're being given flip-flops, being given food, and then it hones in on her and her look and what's going through her little mind. We have no idea. You know, it's a child's world. But to her, you know, it's all games as well. But she knows that she's being taken from her home to Sweden, and that's how we learn about it, because at no point are you told where they are, where they're going, really, apart from a song that she sings where she says, oh, we're going to Sweden in Germany to live with Grandpa, you know.
That was a really endearing moment. Yeah, I think it was there to help keep her going through that journey. And Zita, I want to bring you in here. What was your impression of the film? Do you agree with Maria's take?
I agree with quite a bit of what Maria has said. I think it was quite endearing to show it through the eyes of a child in the way it was shot. It was a unique perspective that we don't normally see or hear. Usually the times we hear about children are in a very technical way, as you know, unaccompanied minors or when they tragically died. So it was positive to see it from the perspective of a child, but I also think that in some places, you know, the narrative was missing. But you have to look at what the purpose of the film was, and was it to do what lots of other people have done before, or was it to do something different and to show this perspective on it?
No, I agree with you, actually, and I want to explore those details a bit later on in terms of how powerful that impact had by having minimal dialogue. She's such a cute, gorgeous little girl, Leanne, and as a viewer, I feel like you feel the need to protect her in that hostile world that she's in. And Maria, you were touching upon this a bit earlier on. What are some of the hardships that we witness Leanne and her family encounter on their journey?
Well, there's an interesting shot of them all being sort of held against a barrier and the police kind of treating these refugees as cattle, really. And you kind of think, that this isn't on, you know, this isn't right. But I don't think that's what the film wants to show you. I think it wants to show you the fact that they don't know what's happening. She doesn't know what's happening. It's crazy. It's frightening in many ways. And it's disorientating. So hence why there's no narration. You have no idea where they are at any given time, what country they're in.
Do you think this is a metaphor in general, sorry, as the viewers, that we sympathise with Leanne because it's a metaphor for the Western audience's general ignorance of the issue, perhaps, that we don't know where they are, what's happening?
Well, exactly, yes, in some ways. And also that she's an ordinary little girl. She's got a backpack from the film Frozen. You know, this could be any of us at any given time. And basically to, you know, come to terms, sort of empathise with her situation. The thing is, we've seen films where you see children being, you know, treated horrifically. And so this is a different way of getting the message across. And poignantly, and with this three-year-old girl, and she is very similar. I mean, she's gorgeous to look at, and very sweet, and very cute, and very funny. There's a scene where she's playing with her sister, and she's, you know, giving her a lollipop, and the whole thing is that the family are trying to keep it as normal as possible, but it isn't a normal situation.
And Zita, from your experience working with refugees and refugee children, what kind of conditions are they enduring, and kind of problems that they have on journey?
Well, they're going through horrific conditions and experiences. What we didn't see in the film for Leanne is some of the experiences that refugee children that I've met and worked with, where, you know, they're having to cross deserts, where they're having to go on very small boats in perilous conditions across the Mediterranean Sea. And effectively, you know, the families are risking their lives to get them to a safe place. They're staying in very harsh conditions, where at the moment, if you look at what's happening in Calais, where both of the camps destroyed, people don't have tents. They're staying outside. The police have been stealing their blankets and their sleeping bags, if they get them, and stripping those away from them. They were over the last few months, they've had a one-hour slot in which they can access a tank of water to have a wash in front of hundreds of people. So actually, the conditions are stark. When there wasn't an infrastructure in Dunkirk, and particularly in Calais, there was a school and an art school, and so there was some system in place for children to have, you know, snippets of normality.
So would you say that Leanne workshops. Is one of the lucky ones that got away?
If you look at her journey in the film, for the bits that we see of it, seems to be quite a positive journey compared to some of the refugee children I've met. I'm not saying it's completely positive, because obviously a long journey like that, there are risks all the way. It's tiring. You're staying in tents and camps and so on, so it's not easy. But I also think I don't quite agree with you in terms of Leanne's naivety. I think actually she's very intelligent and very articulate. And if you listen to the little things she says and the little songs she sings, you can see actually she is reflecting on her conditions, particularly on the coach when she talks about what happened to the cat.
Yeah? Yes, I thought that was more really engaging. I wish I saw more of those scenes. So as we were saying, do enjoy watching these tender, sweet moments with Leanne and these precious moments. I think they give us a sense of relief from the harsh reality of a refugee's life. Maria, the director, Larsen, said at the Copenhagen Film Festival earlier this year that in this film he didn't want to focus so much on the political aspect of the refugee crisis. He wanted to focus more on a child's perspective and sort of it gives some hope, I suppose, to their situation. Do you think that the film should have been more political, though?
It's an interesting question. The thing is, if it had been more political, then it would have been like every other documentary that we've seen on the refugee crisis. He was trying to get his point of view across by Leanne, and he succeeded that to some certain extent. The thing is that it is a snapshot of what they went through. We don't know what the rest of it was like. You know, anyone who has a three-year-old, to keep them entertained for 86 days, I'm sorry, but it would be a nightmare, you know. The thing is, we need to be hopeful, but we need to change people's attitudes, and people are now kind of entrenched about the Syrian refugee crisis, sadly, and this is a different way of putting it across, to engage people in that discussion and to look at it. Like it is, you know, we're like voyeurs in this film, and what we see is what he's allowing us to see. So the rest may have not been as touching or, you know, as moving or as sweet as the scenes that we saw. Mm-hmm. It'd be interesting to see, you know, as I said, keeping a three-year-old entertained or protected from what's going on is really difficult. Their attention span is very short.
Mm-hmm. And I think Larsen used the child, though, on purpose in the sense that she's untainted by the world, and she's an innocent, pure soul. So she doesn't know the differences with the cultural and political conflicts.
No.
So in a sense, it gives you a sort of humanistic approach, I think, to the refugee crisis.
And you need to put a face on it. That's the thing. You've got to humanise people. You know, you can't just say, you know, bunch of Syrian refugees as a whole. These are people. These are people just like you and like us going through terrible ordeal. You know, to have to move from, you know, your country to somewhere completely foreign. My parents did it, you know, in the 60s. And my mother kind of never got over it, really, because it was a completely different culture coming to Britain. Circumstances, you can't, they're not comparable. But what I'm saying is if you have to leave your home, and in their case, they're forced to leave their home to go somewhere else, and people are not giving them the respect that they kind of deserve, or the kindness. Do you see what I mean?
No, I see what you mean. It's a really good point.
It's you know, we're supposed to, you know, care for everyone. We're supposed to care for each other, and we've become, you know, in the world now where it's every man and woman for themselves.
Mm-hmm. And Zita, I just wanted to read a statistic here about refugees. So according to the UN Refugee Agency, 86% of the world's refugees are hosted by developing countries. So the countries hosting the most refugees are Turkey, so home to some 2.5 million, Pakistan, 1.6 million, Lebanon, 1.1 million, and Iran, around 1 million. Now, What do you think of the Western world's efforts in sheltering and accommodating the refugees? Do you think they could be doing a better job?
They could definitely be doing far more than they're doing. Actually, the UK record is woeful. You know, for 2 years I've been working with people who are refugees in France who are stuck in limbo, effectively, trying to get to the UK. Many of them are children. The average age currently of the people that are there, if you want to call them adults, is around age 17 or 18. So this is very young people that have left home when they were children, have struggled and travelled alone, may have lost all their family members, have had to form bonds and family to travel across Europe to try and get to a safe place, and are being separated from their families and connections here in the UK. And then all the scapegoating and demonising of migrants, and trying to blame the cuts and austerity impact that we're experiencing here on migrants is an absolute disgrace. We've had the Immigration Act introduced in the UK, which is like seeks to create an apartheid-like state. And then even when people are here, we're seeing mass deportations to countries like Jamaica, Nigeria and Pakistan. So yes, the UK and other European Western countries could do far more. They are not demonstrating humanity. And actually, I think that's what we saw in the film. We saw the human story. We saw humanity. We saw the reality of a family trying to shield and protect their children. And you could see the sadness and pain and fear in the eyes of the adults, but they tried to protect the children from that and, you know, keep things positive so that the children, and particularly Leanne, could have hope for a better future.
Thank you for that point. It was a really good point. I want to touch more on what you were saying about the anti-refugee sentiment across Europe. Now, we're in the final part of the discussion of this programme now, and I just want to talk a little bit about how in the documentary there isn't no specific reference to the country of origin of the refugees. Do you think Larson did this in an attempt to perhaps internationalise the refugee issue?
Maybe, but also to keep you disorientated in a way, like they were. We assume that they started off from a Greek port and then they go through, I think they went through Hungary and Austria and then Germany and then on to Sweden. But you have no idea where they're going or what's the passage of time, actually. You know, and only by the signposts and people speaking in German do you realise they're in Germany. Mm-hmm. So that's basically to keep it, you know, to keep you on your toes and to give you the experience or part of the experience that they went through, because Leanne had no idea where she was going.
Mm-hmm. And Zita, would you agree with Maria's take?
Not necessarily. I can't speculate on why it was done like that and why it wasn't mentioned. You know, within a few minutes, I'd figured out that's where they were from anyway, because I can hear them speaking and, you know, I can look at them and guess where they're from. But actually, I think the important part of the film wasn't about... He wasn't trying to tell their backstory and what they were fleeing from. There was no focus on that. It was about the journey you go on as a refugee. So all people who are refugees are going through those same trials and tribulations and challenges, and, you know, it's tiring, it's long, it's challenging. So I think that the focus was on, this is what you're going through. Here is a family who are a tight family, who are supporting each other, looking after each other. They're a loving family. You know, they're embracing their children. They're sticking together. And this is what you have to do to get through a perilous and long and difficult journey, which is not just physically difficult, but actually mentally and spiritually.
And psychologically, yeah. Definitely. But I just wanted to ask you, a lot of people would argue that, in fact, refugees getting to their destination in Europe is actually not the hardest part, given the rise of the increase in anti-refugee, anti-immigrant sentiment in Europe, with far-right groups, for example. Do you think it's likely that children such as Leanne will face a lot of racism and abuse once they settle in the countries?
Absolutely. Actually, I sat, you know, as the credits came up at the end of the film, thinking, OK, this is all very fairy tale, happily ever after. This is not the reality of what people go through as refugees, or even migrating, you know, where my family came and migrated to the UK. she will face discrimination. And often young people that I meet who are refugees in France, they ask, what's it like in the UK? It's better there, and it's going to be better for us, and it's going to be better equality. And I'm truthful to them. I tell them what I do as an activist, that actually my entire life has been dedicated to campaigning against racism and prejudice and xenophobia, because we're still facing those challenges. So it won't be easy for her. It's going to be challenging.
So Marie, would you like to see a follow-up documentary to see how Leanne's life would play out?
It would be interesting, but again, if he's going to go for this style of documentary, then, you know, it's cinematic, basically. But I suspect as a three-year-old, I mean, I was 10 months old when I came to Britain, you get used to your surroundings and, you know, you become part of society and you forget what...
You integrate
there. And she's three, and she will presumably integrate. But, yeah, it's...
Perhaps many challenges lie ahead. And
indeed.
We'll just have to...
And it's scary times at the moment, and also after post-Brexit, I have to say. So
it's scary times indeed. And I'm afraid we'll have to end it there, but thank you very much. I enjoyed this discussion of the documentary. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thanks to my guests and to you. I've been Camelia Shambayati.
و به توفیق الهی امت اسلامی و ملت مسلمان فلسطین بر دشمنان خودشون قطعا پیروز خواهند شد و خواهند دید اون روزی را که ریشه رژیم جعلی صهیونیست از سرزمین فلسطین کنده خواهد شد.
With God's grace and divine providence, the Islamic Ummah and the Palestinian nation will emerge victorious, inflicting a decisive defeat on their enemies. And we shall see the day when the fake Zionist regime will be uprooted once and for all from the land of Palestine. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei.
World Quartz Day. The illegitimate birth of the Israeli regime was in 1948, through unlawful occupation of Palestine and expulsion of its people from their ancestral homeland. For the past seven decades, the people of Palestine have suffered the most heinous crimes throughout history. The latest stratagem of the usurper Israeli regime has been focused on two strategic goals, undermining the resistance front and normalization of ties with Arab countries. In view of this, some of the reactionary Arab regimes, alongside Western regimes and the Israeli regime, have formed the unholy Western Arab Jewish Alliance to impose their scandalous scheme, dubbed Deal of the Century, on regional countries. Ali Akbar Velayati, a senior aide to the leader of the Islamic Revolution and Secretary General of the Global Islamic Awakening Forum, says, "The Americans and the Zionists, following the failure of this scheme, the deal of the century, in a bid to deceive domestic opinion in the brink of elections and with another humiliating scheme, have urged their regional minions to render another service to the Zionist lobby through disclosure and normalization of hidden and scandalous ties. But the jigsaw puzzle of treason and reneging on the cause of Palestine will ultimately lead to the domino of collapse and expiry of the mercenary rulers. And the wakeful, free, faithful, and justice-seeking, truth-seeking people of this world, especially in this sensitive juncture in history, will stand against the reactionary rulers with vigilance, insight, and vision, and will chant the cry of truth-seeking, independence, and freedom of the oppressed Palestinian people. And Yekfar Belaiti continued by saying that 50 years of resistance and 20 years of face-to-face struggle of the Palestinians and Lebanese nation against the Zionist regime has totally destroyed the illusion of the Zionist dream of ruling from Nile to Euphrates among Israeli officials. That's why they have ensconced themselves inside tall walls out of fear of the Palestinian nation's wrath. The Zionists have pursued two goals since the illegitimate birth of the Israeli regime in 1948. Their first goal has been to attain legitimacy, which has never materialized, as the Palestinian resistance has posed a real challenge to the Israeli regime. Their second goal has been to dominate over Al-Quds, the first Qibla of Muslims, in a bid to change the identity of this holy city. In view of this, Al-Quds has been under Israeli occupation since 1967. The founder of the Islamic Revolution, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, in order to boost the Palestinian cause and to show support for the Palestinian nation, declared the last Friday of the blessed month of Ramadan as World Quds Day, to revive the cause of Palestine and breathe new spirit and life in the core of Islamic Ummah against the criminal enemies who sought to cast this holy cause into oblivion. The late Imam Khomeini called on all Muslims in the world to mark this day as a means of unity with the oppressed Palestinian nation. This brave decision showed that the issue of Palestine is the top priority of the Islamic world, and that the issue of Palestine will never be forgotten. This year, as in all previous years, Muslim nations are holding demonstrations, rallies, and marches, although some restrictions have been imposed because of the coronavirus pandemic. Yet, the message of this great day has been internalized throughout the world as a symbol of struggle against oppression and occupation. Emphasis on unity of the Islamic world, highlighting the issue of Palestine as the top issue of the Islamic world, and trying to inspire hope amongst the Palestinians are among the main messages of World Quds Day. Intellectuals, elites, academics, and masses of people can play an important role in awakening and enlightening Islamic communities. In the current critical conditions that the enemies, intent on insist on occupying Palestine and dominating over material and spiritual interests of West Asia through overt and covert conspiracies. Explication of different aspects of the schemes like normalization of ties and the unholy deed of the century will surely awaken people, particularly the younger generation. Commenting on the Palestinian problem and the issue of Palestine, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has said, "With regards to Palestine, the three events of occupation of the Palestinian land, the million-strong exile of the Palestinian people, and the relentless massacring and crimes against humanity committed against the Palestinians have been unprecedented in history. The leader also said in this important statement, the second step or the second phase of the Islamic Revolution, the leader said, the Islamic Revolution has courageously defended the oppressed and downtrodden. This revolution is a source of pride for the Iranian nation and for the Iranian people, and may this persist forever. We have shown our chivalry, our honesty, our frankness, and we have helped the downtrodden and the oppressed. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on the occasion of the birth anniversary of Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, said, the oppression of the peoples in Palestine, in Yemen, the